Blog Talk Radio.
Too much month left over at the end of the money? Bad credit holding you back? Want to become a real estate investor but haven't won the lottery? Learn how to fix your credit, get out of debt, and build true financial independence with real estate in 1 hour a week. Tune in to Unlock Your Wealth Radio with Heather Wagner. She'll show you how without winning the lottery or working 10 jobs. And here's your host, Heather Wagner.
Greetings and salutations, everyone. Welcome to the broadcast this week. You are listening to Unlock Your Wealth Radio. I'm your hostess, Heather Wagenhals. For this fabulous Money May 23rd, we are broadcasting live from the Log Mahal in Payson, Arizona. And this Saturday, as well as every Saturday at 10 a.m., we broadcast Unlock Your Wealth Radio and talk about crisis management and financial wellness tools designed to help every man, woman, and child alike manage their finances and attitudes for the single purpose of financial independence. And this week's key is break the budget, and have we got an exciting show for you in store today. We have two doctors that are going to show up on today's show. One's a medical doctor, one's a doctor of economics, and either way, we are going to work to help create the mindset for financial independence. Additionally, this week, we always have our trivia question where you can call in to win. Our trivia question is set up to take callers and answer a question where the information was given on the previous broadcast. How do you get the previous broadcast or the question and even have a chance to know? Well, in addition to listening live, you can also download the show at any time during the week. And if you are a subscriber to the e-zine, you can get the question before everybody else does. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to last week's broadcast or you're not sure of the answer, you can always have time to download and review. In order to subscribe to the e-zine, you can do it one of two ways. You can visit our website at www.unlockyourwealth.com and drop your email in the subscription box, and you too will then receive weekly updates about the show, its upcoming guests, and that ever popular trivia question. Also, you can, if you are not handy with the internet and not able to log in and go to the website and drop in your email, you can simply send us an email. And you do that simply by putting in the subject line, subscribe me, and send an email to ezine@unlockyourwealth.com. That's ezine@unlockyourwealth.com. So today's question is name one of the 10 money drains we talked about last week. They seem like little cash outflows here and there, but as you add them up, they become big bucks and can be one of those financial busts for us if we don't pay attention to those. So there's 10 of those. So if you want to try to win, today we have 13 weeks of financial coaching and an autographed book from one of our doctors today, one of our featured guests. So name one of the 10 money drains we talked about last week. The number to call in to win next hour when we give the trivia question and start to take callers is area code 718-508-9002. That's 718-508-9002. And again, this is to call in for the trivia question, which we will take in the next hour. Minutes on Your Money this week is pretty good. We've got Secrets of Successful Savers, A Simpler Way, Maybe Not. But this article is about the 60% solution. Three bad reasons to buy a home, and another three steps back to the sanity of using cash. For our Investor's Edge segment, we have economist Dr. Anthony Downs, who's going to talk about his latest book and talk about the real estate crisis and what you can do to avert significant financial damage and still pursue financial independence even in these economic times. Our fabulous segment host, Karen Gurm, is out this week, and so we will not have our News by the Numbers segment. But moving forward, we will still have our nuts and bolts. We'll have this week's key, which again is break the budget, and our key statement, key affirmation, and key action item for you to work on through the next week until we meet again next Saturday. Now, today's key is about breaking the budget. And what we're going to do in this segment is we're going to examine budgeting and those negative connotations that are associated with it. And instead of going on a strict budget, we're going to learn how to create a healthy savings and spending plan by going back to our second key, where we talked about how to evaluate what our current spending habits are before we go nuts creating a budget. And that way we can assess in moderation and be reasonable and be able to create a program that has lasting benefits. Now, if all of this sounds familiar to you, like you've heard this song and dance in another genre, yes, you have. One of the things that I have in my book about budgeting is it's a lot like dieting. And when we think of the word dieting, we start to panic. We think, oh my gosh, what do I have to give up? What do I have to abstain from? What do I have to do that's totally crazy and off the wall that, well, I've convinced myself for now that I can do this long term, it's not going to be beneficial for my psyche or my waistline, and it's probably going to jeopardize my health as well. Well, that brings us to our first guest today, who is Dr. Gino Tutera. Now, I personally am a patient of Dr. Tutera's, but in addition to that, I selected him as our guest today because Dr. Tutera is recognized worldwide as a pioneer and leader in the field of bioidentical hormone replacement therapy. He has practiced medicine for over 30 years and specializes in the natural hormone therapy of hormonal deficiency and a sustainable weight loss. Dr. Tutera developed his unique SOTA-PELE hormone replacement therapy based on the use of subcutaneous hormone replacement therapy pellets, which is the most effective hormone delivery system available when undergoing hormone replacement therapy. He has published two books on the subject, You Don't Have to Live with It and Life Regained, The Real Solution to Managing Menopause and Andropause, which is the male version of menopause for those of you who don't know. And these books give deep insight into hormone replacement therapy, and Gino Tutera also has a parallel or sister program with the Diodore Weight Loss Centers. And we're going to talk a little bit about why traditional dieting doesn't work with Dr. Tutera, as well as the psychological impact that that has and how we can overcome that and use those same principles from dieting to also create a healthy savings and spending plan for us so we can also whittle our wallet waistline as well as our physical waistline. Dr. Tutera, welcome to the broadcast. Dr. Tutera, are you there? Hello, Dr. Tutera. Dr. Tutera, can you hear me?
I can now.
Yay! Oh, that was a struggle. Technical issues always seem to beset the show, no matter how much I commit to technology excellence. Well, welcome to the broadcast, Dr. Tutera. It's so great to have you on today.
Thank you, Heather. Appreciate that. How are you?
I am very well, thank you very much, and I am excited because this is my anniversary weekend, so I'm having a second honeymoon, if you will, hiding out here at the cabin broadcasting from Payson, so I thought this would be a great place to hide away for a few days, and we have the extra bonus of having the holiday be this weekend for Memorial Day as well, so we got an extra day to celebrate. So that's what I'm doing this weekend show. In addition to today's broadcast, I'm also delighted for this weekend for that particular reason, too.
Good. Congratulations.
Now, thank you very much. And I also want to thank you for being a part of the broadcast, because people get confused, and, you know, they compartmentalize their lives in so many ways. You know, mentally they have this financial part of their life, and then they have this familial part of their life, and their spiritual part of their life, and then they have their health part of their life, and none of it is integrated. And some of the bad habits that we adopt in certain categories we bring over to others, not realizing what we're doing, even though we have worked so hard to compartmentalize our lives and have each one operate independently. But true integrity is when we can be congruous in all of our lives. And as I was looking at the psychological ramifications of budgeting and what people do when they budget and they go on and they go off and then they splurge and spend, and I started to draw some incredible correlations to what people do when they diet and how it's tied to emotion and a bunch of preconceived ideas that either other people, our family, or ourselves have put upon us, like, well, I'm always fat because, well, my family is big-boned and things like that. And so I kind of wanted to talk to you today because you specialize in non-surgical weight loss and creating a level of health and wellness, much like I do with money. You do this with the physical being. And your Diodori website has a page that talks about why diets fail. Can you just talk about some of those items about why diets fail?
Well, unfortunately, you know, when we go on some of these programs, you know, if you want to call them that, they basically vary from what our bodies normally would expect, you know, as far as the nutritional wellness that is necessary for us to bring energy and wellness into our lives. And when we start denying ourselves, you know, carbohydrates, or we start focusing on giving ourselves, you know, certain restrictions as to what we can have, what we can't have, you know, it really leads to a mindset that will, you know, ultimately fail, because when you have to reintroduce all these things that you've basically taken away, you know, it's usually, you know, a disaster. And this, the yo-yo effect is probably the worst thing that we find. And as, you know, as you lose 20 pounds and then within, you know, 6 months you gain back 22, you know, you say, oh, these things never work for me, and there's nothing that, you know, I've tried everything in the world, except for the fact that, you know, we haven't really tried to integrate, you know, the logical, natural things that our bodies necessitate, such as maintaining normal insulin levels, maintaining normal, you know, the normal concentration of protein and carbohydrate in our intake. And if we do that, then this is a lifestyle and not a diet that can be, you know, that can be continued for, you know, forever, and not really deny ourselves, you know, some of the things that, you know, that we have to put ourselves through to try and lose, you know, 5 or 10 pounds, such as, you know, only eating grapefruit or a cabbage diet, or having, you know, the Atkins diet where you eat nothing but, you know, but fats. And sure, these things will work in the short term, but in the long term, you know, success is minimal. And the fact is, in the United States, long-term success for all of those diets is about six, as far as being able to maintain the weight loss that you have, is about 6%. And 6% is really a lousy percentage, you know, to expect, you know, any sort of a successful outcome. You know, if you're only getting a 6%, you know, out of what you're doing, then you need to look for something else. And this is why, you know, when you use these, you know, quote-unquote diets, whether it be the HCG diet, whether it be the, you know, the Atkins diet and all, you need to really be focusing on putting in the proper ratio of protein, carbohydrate, so that you keep your insulin levels down, because it's insulin excess that makes us deposit fat. And if you put yourself on a program like we have, then you can you can carry this through for the rest of your life and be able to maintain, your weight loss. We have individuals that have lost, in excess of 100 pounds who are doing quite well in their maintenance area because they don't have to change what they're doing. They are still, eating the same and doing, having the same intake, the same exercise and all that they did when they were in the weight loss phase, other than the fact that they, because of their weight loss, they're able to take in more protein, which is, helps them build their muscle and maintain muscle mass, which, just translates into wellness. So that's why diets don't work. Diets are a short-term answer to a long-term problem, or to trying to get a short-term answer for a long-term problem, and what you need is a lifestyle adjustment that will allow the body to lose and burn fat, because it's not your weight that's going to kill you, it's the amount of fat that you're carrying, and that directly relates to the amount of insulin your body secretes, and if it over-secretes it, you're in trouble. And that's exactly what happens when you start transitioning off a dietary program. The insulin levels will start to skyrocket as you add back the things that you used to have in your diet, and all of a sudden the fat just comes cascading back. So it's what we do is, initiate people into doing the things that, will last them for the lifetime. I hope that's that's rather long-winded, but I hope that helps in your audience in understanding, the difference.
No, it's great, and I agree wholeheartedly with you. For my genre, it is a short-term answer for a long-term challenge, and until people can see things differently and make lifestyle changes versus just these radical short-term answers that don't ever give them what results that they want toward, the end. And then they feel like, oh, well, that didn't work. I don't know why I bothered to do that. And then they go and then they splurge. And for you, they start eating again or reintroduce food. And instead of creating that systematic lifestyle change so the pattern can then be permanent for future health and wellness, both personally and financially, they're not ever going to get what they want out of budgeting or dieting. When you first see a person, and I'm just trying to draw some more correlations from when I first see someone who comes to me with severe financial issues, what's the mindset that you find when you have a patient that first comes to Diradori? Have they already been on the yo-yo and tried the cycles, and what brings them there, and what's their mindset when you first meet with them?
Well, when you, it's not unlike what you do. It's that, that if they don't, financially, if they don't start changing what they're doing, they're never going to succeed in what they're in accumulating and accruing wealth. And when they come to see me, it's the same thing. They've already tried three or four different things looking for a short-term answer, like I want to lose 20 pounds, when in actuality, we try and educate these each individual to understanding that, don't make this a commitment. I lose 20 pounds and that's going to be the end of it, because, being able to stay healthy and well is a lifetime of a commitment. It's not just that, 6 weeks or 8 weeks that, that you're on this diet and then all of a sudden you fall back into your bad habits. And so what happens is that once they get through the dietary aspect of it, they need to be educated that basically you can't go back to your old habits any longer. You have to adopt and be resolute in adopting every aspect of the things that we give you, such as not only the proper food intake, but also the lifestyle change as far as doing the proper exercises to initiate fat burn, and being able to incorporate this into a daily living pattern, so that success, is maintained for a long period of time, and not just for that 6 months after that, where you start seeing all the weight start to tumble back. And unfortunately, what happens is that, you know, when I see people come in, they've already been on three programs on the average, whether it be Jenny Craig or some of the others that are, you know, being advertised. And what happens is that, you know, they adopt it for a while, and then all of a sudden they lose focus, and they lose their ability to concentrate and stay on, you know, and stay within the guidelines that were offered with us. And what we select is that we give our individuals guidelines that can be followed for the rest of their life, and they don't have to make, you know, the only adjustments they have to make is things that they already have been educated by us, such as when they go out to eat, what happens, you know, what they should do, and how they, you know, and how they should, you know, apportion their proteins and fats and carbohydrates. And that really leads to long-term success. And it's the same way, you know, I would think in the financial area where, you invest for the long term and not just trying to get those short-term riches, because usually what happens is most of the people, you know, that go for short-term answers wind up losing their shirts. So what we try and do is make sure that they stay healthy for a long period of time.
That's great. Now, when you go through all of these guidelines that you give them, what do you share with your patients is the most critical part of the program that will lead to their success, but is not necessarily like the fat, carbohydrate, protein part of it? What is the most critical part to long-term success for your patients?
I think it's buying into the idea that, you know, that this is a lifestyle change and not a diet. I think that they have to buy into that concept, that this is something that needs to be employed for the rest of their lives, and, you know, not just a short-term answer. And if they can buy into that, then they're more likely to be very successful. If they don't buy into it, you know, they're going to go down the same unsuccessful road that they've been through before, because as soon as they get that 10 pounds off, then they go back to their old habits, and, you know, and then they all of a sudden say, well, that didn't work for me. Well, if you don't make the commitment right from the very start, then you're not going to be very successful.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see the lasting success occurring, through the process or in the maintenance phase?
The long-term success really is when we do in the maintenance phase is that we have the individuals, you know, go out there and, you know, now they've lost their whatever weight that they want to achieve, and we let the individual, you know, set that goal. What is, you know, where do you think you'll be the most comfortable? Not how much weight do you want to lose, but where is it that you're most comfortable? And the long-term success thing comes from, we have them come back on at least a once-a-month basis just to sit down and talk, see how they're doing, give them a slap on the back, tell them how well they do, or if they're starting to slip, you know, and they've gained back a few pounds, reemphasize to them, this is what you think, you know, this is where you need to stop it. You had a little bit of fun. Now it's time to get back on, you know, back on to the program. And within a very short period of time, they're back to where they were before, doing the things that they were doing before that made them so successful. And I think it's that ongoing support that they receive from us, you know, and they can employ it forever if they want to, that, you know, makes it so successful. Whereas in other programs, once you get the goal weight out the door, you go, and if you want to come back, it costs, you know, you have to go through the whole program again. And that's not, you know, that's just counterproductive.
Mm-hmm. I find that the success for my clients working to achieve financial independence also rests in that accountability factor and continually reviewing. And one of our keys in the Keys to Riches is review, revise, and recommit. And so it allows us to take a look at what we have been doing, and if it's been great, you know, we make that commitment to continue. And if we have fallen off the wagon, this is our chance to nip it in the bud, and then we take and recommit to getting back on track. and then, you know, moving forward. But we keep that accountability in place because I personally feel that's where the lasting success is as well.
Yeah, it's so important for them to come in at least once a month just to come in and, you know, get on the scale, see what, and catch them before they really get into, you know, a big backslide. And whether it be in the wellness area or whether it be in the financial area, they are so integrated. If you can't make your lifestyle a success, it's difficult, you know, to become financially successful as well. They are all, you know, because the same things that we do in each area basically are what lead to ultimate success in both areas. So I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Yay, and so we can whittle our wallet and waistline at the same time and be healthy and wealthy and wise.
There you go.
Well, I'm so grateful that you came on the show today, and also thank you for the autographed books that we will be giving away with our trivia question in the next hour. And I hope that Nurse Carol Ann takes good care of you this weekend as you're recovering from your hip surgery.
You betcha. Yep.
Well, thanks again, and you take care and have a happy Memorial Day.
You too, and thanks so very much for having me.
Anytime, Dr. Tutero.
All right.
Well, thanks so much for Dr. Tutero joining us on the broadcast, and we have much more ahead. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Tony Stewart, driver of the number 14 Office Depot Old Spice Chevrolet, and you're listening to Heather Wagonhals on Unlock Your Wealth Radio.
In life for free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want. That's what I want. That's what I want. Your love gives me such a thrill, but your love won't pay my bills. I want money.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Unlock Your Wealth Radio. I'm your hostess, Heather Wagonhals. And for those of you who are joining us for the first time, welcome aboard for this Memorial Day weekend. My brother is serving in the military, and so I am grateful for all of you that pay your respects and honor those who have served and are continuing to serve. You're listening to Unlock Your Wealth Radio, where this Saturday and every Saturday we broadcast this program and talk about crisis management and financial wellness tools designed to help everyone manage their finances and attitudes for the single purpose of financial independence. We're so grateful for Dr. Gino Tutera's appearance on today's show, and a lot of people never really think about these two things together, budgeting and dieting, but they are so hand in hand. And like I was sharing in the last segment, you know, we don't think about our lives as an integrated whole being. We have compartmentalized these sections of our lives. This is our work life. This is our social life. This is our spiritual life. This is our family life. But it's all one life, and the skills that we do or do not have in one area will, unfortunately, bleed over. And if you're struggling with weight management and financial management, there might be something to that. Just food for thought. no pun intended, since we're talking about dieting. But this plays really well into our discussion that we'll have today during our Nuts and Bolts segment. It's a pretty important thing to consider as you move forward. How am I going to manage my life? And when you think about how have I managed my health, and if you say, yes, I've been pretty successful, well, why don't I explore what those techniques are that have made me successful in my health category and apply those same techniques. And they're the same. It's all about discipline and choices. And if you are successful in making discipline and choices for your health, you can also be successful by making decisions, those same quality decisions in your financial life as well. That's where our affirmations come in from our first key, where we have taken and in our acceptance and affirmation key, where we have created a list of affirmations that help get us over that negative self-talk from that killer curmudgeon inside of us who tells us we're not capable of doing things or being successful at certain things. And we can translate all of those fabulously successful health management techniques into our financial management as well. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the next in our upcoming segment for Nuts and Bolts. But on to Minutes on Your Money. We have some really great articles to talk about today. I'm so excited. As you all know, I'm always surfing the internet because I would like one more tool for my financial toolbox. As we know, the last key is become a voracious reader, and I cannot stop learning. And I believe if you stop learning, you stop living. And I also know that I am not the be-all, end-all to financial wellness. And so I'm always looking to see somebody else's viewpoint and their position or technique or take on money management. And I like to bring those to you, the good, the bad, and the ugly, so we can talk about them and see how we can create or integrate this into our lives. This was from MSN Money by a really great writer, M.P. Dunleavy. And she writes, The Secrets of Successful Savers. And she writes, lots of people who manage to stash away cash feel tempted not to. But here are their strategies for keeping their spendthrift selves in check. And if you're having trouble saving money, welcome to the club. You're not the only one. In the best of times, saving is tough because you always think, oh, the money will never end. But here we are. These aren't the best of times. And in fact, sometimes it can seem as if the universe is conspiring against you. I know that I have experienced that more than once in my lifetime when it came to money and savings. Now, Angela Bauer, a Women in Red member, and this is a new financial group, she writes, how is that the minute that you have to spare $25 to save that there's a mysterious $25 expense? But it's the phenomenon that a lot of people struggle with as they try to reach their savings goals. She says, though, several psychologists and economists that she's interviewed said when it comes to saving, money is almost like the last thing you need to worry about. And so that's what kind of raised my eyebrow when I wanted to read this article. It says, it's not the money. When all the economics research suggests is that you don't have to find more money to save, you just need to be very intentional with the money you have. That's why we're breaking the budget, and we're doing it a little bit differently. She is founder of an organization called Women in Red Savers, and she has helped and watched hundreds of women become successful savers. She does this, she says you need to embrace inertia, and she does this by saying it turns out that the most powerful force in our financial behavior isn't knowledge, it's inertia, says Ray Bushera. He's the director of the Asset Building Program for the New America Foundation, which is a nonprofit public policy institute that develops savings programs nationwide. He says, fortunately, much like gravity, fiscal inertia can be useful if you know how to handle it. The aim is to have to do as little as possible. He says, make it automatic. The best strategy are automatic transfers. Some of the women in the Women in Red Club say that there's no way that they would save without it. One member of the Women in Red Savers automatically transfers $1 a day from her checking account to her savings account. It's only $7 a week, she says, and it doesn't sound like much, but the automatic transfer of a single dollar each day points out that she might not find $30 in a month. So that's one strategy. So they said, move your money. Just moving funds from checking into savings seems to deter people from touching their own money, putting that stigma on it that, ooh, I can't spend that. If it's in my checking, I can write a check. But if it's in my savings, that sounds like I'm not supposed to be messing with it. Putting money into a CD or money market account protects your stash even more. One woman put her savings in a bank across town so she'd be less likely to pass it every day. Her point was, by understanding where and when you're likely to fail, you can find clever ways to increase your chances of saving successfully. I kind of like that. Enlist technology. This is another good one. Ask your employer whether it's possible to have part of your paycheck funneled into a savings account instead of direct depositing the whole thing into checking. A growing number of companies offer this option, and so does the Internal Revenue Service, thanks to Form 8888. And you can go download that form at irs.gov. It's in a PDF format. The last thing you want, Bashara says, is to cash that refund check and expect yourself to save any of it. So isn't that great? Instead of having your money returned to you from the IRS in a check, you just have them divert it into your savings account already. So out of sight, out of mind, how fabulous is that? Another secret for successful savers, they share, is harness meaning. There's another powerful element to build into your new savings equation, a sense of personal meaning. Rather than abstractly aiming for a dollar amount, think about why having that nest egg is important to you. Is it because you will sleep better knowing that your family has emergency funds? And it turns out that you really do, and she actually references a sleep study. Is it because you can take courses that could land you a better job, leading to better opportunities for you and your kids? Is savings just about reaching a dollar amount, or is it going to be hard to sustain? Or is it about creating something larger than that? I'm saving money for a purpose, not just for an end goal of a dollar amount. Bauer says that the Women in Red Savers create a sense of meaning and focus by naming their savings account. You may only put $10 a week into your new interview suit fund, but visualizing that new suit and potentially a new job keeps you marching towards your goals. And that's pretty clever. I like doing that. That's part of what we do in Dreams with Deadline. We create our goal, and then we attach as much savory, tasty, emotional feeling and emphasis and visual stimulation to that goal that we can possibly in order to make it more tangible and make it more personal to us. Because if we're just trying to set aside $100, that might not be as easy as if we are setting that aside for a new pair of shoes or a new coat or something, a tangible object that has emotion and value, not dollar value, but an intrinsic or inherent value to you. And that'll make it more tangible. So I like that new interview suit fund, and I like how they do that, that they name every savings account. Keeping up the momentum. Now, here's the one that everybody struggles with, and me included. You know, I by far do not walk on water or a fabulously straight line, but that's where we created the key, forget the perfection principle, because we're not perfect, and sometimes we fall off the wagon. So what they do is, in order to keep up and start the momentum, they say, act fast. Even if you're feeling inspired to save, you can't rely on that motivation to last. And that's from Harvard economist David Laibson. He says that feeling of excitement and momentum is temporary. Don't take it for granted, he advises. Now is the time to take action. That's part of what we do in our second key, take action, make assessment. We've created all of these fabulous affirmations. We're convincing ourselves we're worthy of financial independence, that we're capable of accomplishing it. And now that we've created all this excitement, we know that it can be fleeting. And it's like the, you know, romance of a new love. So what do we have to do? We have to take action as we feel that. The second thing they suggest to keep up the momentum is to get support. Now, this is what Dr. Tara was just referencing. Enlist the support and help of friends. Laibson says, talk to someone about your savings goal and ask them to help you do it. That's why he finally joined Savers after promising to do it. He realized that he needed the accountability and the camaraderie. And to help him stick to his goal, that accountability gave them the strength to stay on track, even though momentum always wanes. And so in order to keep that up, just like what Dr. Tutera does, even after people accomplish their goal, they still create a system of accountability and check up with them to make sure they're on target. And if they're slipping, reminds them about their goals. And sometimes, you know, as life gets going, we forget about things as we have to change diapers, drop kids off at dance and soccer lessons, and we have that big report due at the office or a presentation we need to make to our nonprofit or church. And, you know, saving slips by the wayside, so a support group is super awesome for that. Now, this one I thought was interesting. Save your savings. While conducting a study of how consumers think about savings, Peter Tufano, who's a professor of financial management at the Harvard Business School, he realized many people confuse discounts on merchandise, like, wow, my coat was 50% off, with actually saving money. This is so great because I always talk about this. Skip the misguided spending to save routine. Instead, focus on saving your savings. You know, spaving is what they call it. That's what they gave the term at the turn of the century when you spend to save money. He says, for example, if your grocery receipt shows that you saved $7.49 on that item, put it away. Again, like I have always said to people, if you don't save it in business, that would just be called a reallocation of assets. So if you just go blow that $7.49 somewhere else, you didn't really save it after all. And last but not least, they say make it easy. What are your likely sources of self-sabotage? This is that fabulous killer curmudgeon that runs around inside of us trying to talk about what we know to be better for us. And Shafir, a Princeton psychology professor, recommends making a list and then avoiding them. So if it's a particular store you have a weakness in, a favorite website that you blow lots of cash on, or certain products from a shopaholic friend, self-control is so tiring. But if you arrange your life so that you confront fewer temptations, that's a wise thing altogether. And this simply goes about that lifestyle change that we spoke of with Dr. Tutera. You know, why would you buy Twinkies and have them in your house if you're trying to avoid them? It's setting yourself up for failure. So the real strength for physical health and wellness is to not take those things home from the grocery store. What we can do to employ that same technique in creating financial wellness is to not allow ourselves to be tempted by changing our patterns and our habits so we are unable to be tempted. If we just eliminate the cause of temptation, we can't succumb to it. So anyway, that was Secrets of Successful Savers. I really, really liked that one. I'm going to bring a bummer one that I want to talk about, and that is a simpler way to save. Richard Jenkins came up with this 60% solution, but I really can't say that I feel like this is a good rule. He says, 20 years of complicated budgeting calculations have led him to this simple conclusion. By eliminating all essential spending, the 60% of your total income savings will soar. My first and most significant flaw with this comes from the simple fact that Uncle Sam takes almost 30% of your income every month, every paycheck. So if he's taking 60 or 30 and you're blowing 60 on essential need items, that gives you 10% to save or allocate for non-essential items. I mean, you know, just like dieting, we can't starve ourselves. We have to be able to reward ourselves along the way. And without that, you know, we're not going to be long-term successful at financial money management. Because what little we can save when we go on the budget, we're going to wind up blowing the first chance we get, and we're going to overdo it and probably not just spend our savings, but we're also going to spend our credit too. His article isn't all bad, though. There is a few things that he does say, you know, like really big expenses, putting down a big, you know, down payment or putting a new roof on the old home. Those things can cause you tens of thousands of dollars, but, you know, because those aren't items, those are durable good items, and those are preventative maintenance type stuff, you can take and save for them and strategically plan for those assets to be paid for. So he does talk about kind of that, and he talks about understanding what your committed expenses are, but you know, he talks about basic food and clothing, essential household expenses, insurance premiums, charitable contributions. I don't believe those are committed or essential items, the charitable contributions. Because I think of the book, Beware of the Naked Man Who Offers You His Shirt. Now, if you are seriously in debt, you cannot be giving to charitable organizations. You need to be giving to the charity of me, myself, and I, because long term, those charitable contributions may potentially become resentment for you if you really can't afford to be doing them. And number two, you know, I keep going back to this same thing. The airlines tell you to put your oxygen mask on first before putting anybody else's on. Do you know why? Because you cannot take care of others until you take care of yourself. I am a big believer in karma and charitable contribution, and when you give, you receive 10 times. But if you are not financially in control, it's not a committed expense, I'm sorry. And, you know, I'm probably going to get lots of hate mail and people taking me to task for that. But you got to take care of yourself first. You got to get yourself in order. You know, he says budgeting doesn't have to be a straitjacket on fun, but, you know, he creates these categories that he creates these chunks and he orders them in priority. One thing I do like about the chunking is he has a fun money section. So he says, you know, as long as fun money doesn't exceed 10% of the income, it's okay to have fun. But again, you know, the way we break the budget and create our healthy savings and spending plan, we allocate, you know, extracurricular activity money. So 10% seems kind of high to me. Depending on what your obligations are as a family, it may or may not be. But, you know, these things have to be looked at in a holistic approach, and that's why we do our assessment key, and that's why we analyze what we are currently doing before we make any moves to change that. Next article, Liz Pulliam Weston. She's my gal. She's also the number one most read financial writer on the internet. And this is so good, and I kind of like this as a preface to our upcoming guest. Three bad reasons to buy a home. Who's talking about that now? Nobody. Everybody is so fixated on cleaning up our real estate woes with the rate of foreclosures, and everybody's freaking out about money, and, you know, they forget that what was told to us before, go out, buy a home, do this, spend, 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 is what got us here to begin with. Now we have, you know, $8,000 tax credits. We've got all kinds of things that people are trying to sell you on why you should be a homeowner. But let me give you some differing opinions. I love this lady. I like contrarians, too. And I'm hoping that our next guest is going to be a contrarian also, and he's going to share a bunch of information with us that's going to be different from what you think and going to be just fabulous information and food for thought. I'm just excited about Dr. Downs coming on. But three bad reasons to buy a home. Number one, it's a good investment. I like this, and I like what she says. She says the first time she ever wrote a version of this column in 2002, she heard from a lot of people who honestly didn't believe real estate prices could ever fall. The next time she revised the column a few years later, she heard from people who were not only convinced that real estate could only go up, but that real estate guaranteed a far better return than any other investment. And, of course, everybody has learned otherwise. Now, it's all about how you buy. Your money is made, and this is an Investor's Edge topic, is all about how you buy. It's not where you sell. It's about how you buy. And if you're buying to own and live there, you can change up the game plan versus buying for an investment. But she's not convinced that we're at the bottom of the market, and she thinks that this might not be the ideal time to get in. Just because prices have dropped doesn't mean that they can't go any lower. Depending on where your market is and depending on what you're looking at, you know, I can speak to the point of Arizona here because this is where I live and work as a real estate broker. And our company has seen a flurry of activity, but only in certain sectors of the market. Now, I would say that if you're buying in the $275,000 to $600,000 range, you're probably going to still see a lot of prices tumbling. It's not time to buy in those areas, but entry-level housing is cooking. It's on the rise. Most of those foreclosures have already been absorbed. And as far as, you know, activity in the marketplace, we're seeing closings like we did pre-2001 and at the peak. Actually, we're seeing better than the peak in 05 when we had our inventory shortage. You know, we're seeing 100 or more closings every day, sometimes 200 and 300 closings in a day here in Arizona. And given a 20-day work month, I mean, you do the math, you know, that's quite a bit of activity. And, you know, our foreclosures don't represent a significant portion of the marketplace anymore. We're maybe now at 30%. So, again, you know, entry level is on the rise here, so that market is recovering. So if you're looking to invest, that would be a great segment. But, you know, again, middle market is just tanked. But it was overvalued. It was way overvalued. People were paying $500,000-$700,000 for a tract home that was maybe worth $300,000 or $350,000 as a move-up home. Just people went nuts. You know, they got caught up in the frenzy, and so the market kind of took on a life of its own. So it's a good investment. Is not always a good reason to buy, according to her, but depending on what segment you're investing in and what your goals and objectives are, it could be. Her next reason not to buy a home, I'm tired of throwing away money on rent. Well, renting is usually cheaper than owning, and in really expensive cities like New York and San Francisco, renting is so much cheaper that it's tough to make the case for becoming a homeowner in those cities. Buying in these markets often means settling for a crummy property, or you have to move so far out that you have a terrible congested commute compared to what you can afford if you just continued to rent. So you really have to evaluate that. And it all depends, again, on where you live and what city you're living in. You're not really throwing away money on rent when you send a check to the landlord, she says. You're exchanging it for a place to live, and you're getting flexibility and freedom, the things you sacrifice when you buy a home. I disagree with that because when you give a check to a landlord, you're building their wealth, not yours. While you do have a place to live, you're not doing anything to further your position along. Additionally, you don't get an interest tax deduction. So potentially that is a qualified statement depending on where you're living. She does bring up good arguments, though. When you're a renter, you don't have maintenance and repair expenses. And if the neighborhood changes and you start not liking the people who are moving in, you can always move. And you can do that within just a few weeks' notice. So in that section, I think, yeah, possibly there might be a value. But if you're looking to build wealth and live somewhere for a significant period of time, I am still pro-housing. And this one is a good one as far as a bad reason to buy a home. I need the tax deduction. Just because Obama is offering you an $8,000 tax credit, that doesn't mean it's going to offset all the extra costs of owning a home. And how many of you are going to use that tax credit and go blow the cash instead? That is typically what's happening. Instead of using that money to help further your financial independence by reallocating it, neither the tax deduction, if you get it, it's the limited write-off by your tax bracket, so you have to check where you are. If you're in the top federal tax bracket, every dollar you pay in mortgage interest saves you only 35 cents in taxes. So maybe people get even less because they're in the 25% tax bracket or lower. So it all depends. But, you know, buying a house just for the tax deduction is not really a good reason. I like what she says here. Buying a house just for the break is like giving somebody a dollar just to get 35 cents or less in return. You know, some homes, you won't be eligible for those deductions. So depending on where you're at, you need to be prepared. And so if you're just looking for a tax break, this might not be the one for you. If you are in the top tax bracket, after $1,000,001 in mortgage, in principal amount of mortgage, you can't write off the interest. You know, so you know, $1.1 million is it. So if you're thinking that that's why you want to buy, that's the wrong reason. If you're thinking because you want to build financial independence, now there's a way. Our last minute on your money, I'm so excited to bring this one to you, also one by Dunleavy, is 3 steps back to the sanity of cash. For those of you who are uncontrolled credit card-wise, waiting until you have the money in your pocket has its disadvantages, similarly to hand washing dishes, but it will buy security later on. And they're now calling this lifestyle change real income living. Now, she talks about the parable of the appliances, and it's a true story about love, loss, and financial salvation. And I think this is so funny because now they're washing their dishes by hand versus putting them in the dishwasher to save on the electric bill. She says that this shows what happens when you start to think in cash instead of credit, the core of the Women in Red Savers philosophy. Last spring, the oven died, the cooktop still worked, and the dishwasher perished as well. The appliance guy confirmed that they were beyond repair and informed them that the refrigerator was ready to go too. Her husband, at first, took the natural American buy now, pay later approach and didn't think about the cost. He said, let's go to Best Buy or Sears and put some appliances on their credit cards. And he was trying to say that it was an emergency, right? Well, with the economy already shaky, they were scared to owe more money. So they made a novel choice to wait and pay for the appliances with cash. This is pretty interesting. So could you live without credit cards? They sat tight through the summer doing dishes by hand. They got the money together and in September, and ha-ha, the car died. So she says her credit brain started doing the talking. Just buy what you need. That's why you have plastic. And then it started to argue with the cash brain, weak from years of neglect. It was tough to fight back, but says don't buy anything if you don't have the money. So the appliance angel smiled upon them. They heard of somebody getting rid of a stove and fridge in good condition and bought them for cash, and they decided to continue to do without the dishwasher. It wasn't exactly in her plan. She read the Consumer Reports kitchen issue, and she knew what she wanted, but she decided to go with what they could afford. I like how she says this, a thud down to earth. So, interesting thing. She says she has three steps to creating your own personal bailout. She says, I'd wager a cushion of credit has been guiding or misguiding your own financial decisions too, and you could use your own personal bailout. This is an extremely great example of, do I really need it? And no, you don't. You don't need a dishwasher if you have two arms, two legs, and can stand there in front of a sink. Clearly, it is not a need item. It is a want item. So while many Americans can and do handle borrowed refunds responsibly, taking what they need and repaying what they owe, millions more have slipped into a fantasy world of buying and pay later, and that somewhere, somehow, when you least expect it, you're going to pay it all back. But that easy money fog descended, and credit made us all believe we were richer than we were. And so her first step says get out of the fog. You know, every ounce of credit that's available to you now in the form of credit cards or home equity, if it all dried up, what would your life be like? So you have to act as if it is not there. You must get out of the fog. And, you know, dishwasher, that's a few $100. If you don't have a home warranty where you can just make a claim and spend $50 cash to replace it, you know, doing dishes isn't the end of the universe. And it will humble you. Most definitely. It'll help you get on track. Studies by behavioral economics show that credit divorces you from the ouch of spending actual money. It's just the same principle as to why casinos give you chips when you go in to gamble in exchange for your cash, so you're not gambling the cash, because we're more attached to the cash. And it's a study showed that shoppers who paid with plastic didn't remember what they spent versus those who used cash did remember. I like this one. Step two, think of grandma. The second step is switching to a cash-based mindset. That doesn't mean giving up all forms of plastic, but it means to think and spend based on how much money you actually have. You know, if you have to, if you can't pay for it by the end of the month, it doesn't belong on your card. Grandma and her grandmother's grandmother and anybody who lived in the 30s, which is my mother, would never think of borrowing themselves into oblivion. Somehow, they were able to manage to furnish a house, raise and feed a family, procure a car, and save for an emergency with cash. Why? Because it didn't exist. Credit didn't really exist in the credit card form, common use of it until the 70s. So, I mean, we have created a generation of, you know, credit addicts. It's like crack to them. They have no idea how to use real money because they never had to, and they've always been around with debit cards and plastic. You know, this new generation coming up is really going to have a trouble managing their money, and especially with those guilt-ridden parents that raised them, giving them everything they want, and they felt entitled. And when they wanted something, they got it, and credit facilitates that same I want, I get, without having to earn for it. So, finding your means, which is living within your means, it's a personal finance cliche, it seems, because people have lost track of what that means. But LWYN has come to mean that you're fined if you spend every dime that you make. Thanks for playing. If you have to use plastic to cover a few gaps here and there, your vacation, holiday, some groceries, they say it still counts with in living with your own means because you eventually pay it all back, probably. I don't think so. She says, let's rename living within your means for the modern era. Call it real income living. It means because you've got to make hard choices with what to live and save and do that only on what you earn and not what you can charge on plastic. That's going to be the toughest for people if you weren't born of or influenced by someone with that Depression-era frugality. You're going to be in trouble. No two ways about it. Well, that wraps up Minutes on Your Money. We have a lot more in store coming up in our second hour here. Just stay tuned. You are listening. Thank you. Thank you very much. You're listening to Heather Wagenhals, Unlock Your Wealth Radio, this Saturday, Monday, May 23rd. We'll be right back after this. Better Wealth Radio. I'm Heather Wagenhals. It's Fabulous Money, May 23rd. On this Saturday, I am so excited. It is Memorial Day weekend, and I just want to say I hope all of you are paying thanks to those who currently serve and who have served in the military for this Memorial Day weekend. And I'd like to recognize that the show salutes all of those people who are serving in our armed forces or have served, one of which happens to be my beloved brother. And I'm grateful for every day that I sleep soundly knowing that he is protecting us here and abroad. I'm so grateful for that. So welcome to the broadcast. If you were just joining us for the first time, you missed out on the first hour. We had Dr. Gino Tutera from the Diodori Weight Loss Centers and Sotopelli Hormone Therapy Clinics. And we talked about how dieting and budgeting are a lot alike. And in order to have true long-term success, you have to kick those ideals to the curb and create healthy plans. So that's going to be in our upcoming Nuts and Bolts segment. We're going to talk how do we do that. But first, are you a referral partner of the Unlock Your Wealth Radio program? Would you like to promote yourself on our show? Learn about the benefits that our featured advisors receive being part of an exclusive program where the listeners are seeking your financial independence and are in need of your insurance, finance, real estate, and investment services. If you would like to be a part of the Unlock Your Wealth radio program and become a referral partner and receive all of the benefits helping to serve our listeners, please call 1-866-966-9420. That's 866-966-9420. Again, just to remind you, if you would like to call in to try to win the trivia question for today, that's telephone number 718-508-9002, 718-508-9002, and we're going to take calls after the interview. The question, again, from last week's broadcast is, name one, wow, that'd be quite a quiz, wouldn't it? Name one of the 10 money drains we talked about last week with Jerry on the show. 10 of the money drains. Now, we're moving to Investor's Edge. Investor's Edge segment is always geared toward the people who have completed our initial Keys to Riches program and are moving forward looking for advanced techniques to create financial independence and make quality investment decisions. Dr. Anthony Downs is going to help us by giving us some incredible information about his most recent book. Dr. Anthony Downs is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., where he has been since 1977. He is also a visiting fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California in San Francisco from July of 2005 until February of 2006. Brookings is a private nonprofit research organization specializing in public policy studies. The Public Policy Institute Institute of California is a similar organization specializing in studies about California. Before 1977, Downs was for 18 years a member and then chairman of the Real Estate Research Corporation, a nationwide consulting firm advising private and public decision makers on real estate investment, housing policies, and urban affairs. He has also served as a consultant to many of the nation's largest corporations, to major developers, dozens of governmental agencies at local, state, and national levels, including the Department of Housing and Urban Development and the White House, and to many private foundations. President Johnson appointed him to the National Commission on Urban Problems in 1967, and HUD Secretary Jack Kemp appointed him to the Advisory Commission on Regulatory Barriers to Affordable Housing in 1989. He's a director or trustee of the General Growth Properties and the NAACP Legal and Educational Defense Fund. He was also a past director of the Mass Mutual Life Insurance Company, Bedford Property Investors, the Urban Land Institute, one of my favorites, Essex Property Trust and National Housing Partnership Foundation, Penton Media, Inc., and the Counselors of Real Estate. I needed to take a deep breath after going through all of that. But I would love to welcome him to the show, Dr. Anthony Downs. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
You have been quite entertaining to my staff. They have told me I'm going to have fun with you based on some of their conversations with you. And they love your outgoing voicemail message as well.
Thank you.
Now, I have been broadcasting for quite some time, and I have this program on the regular airwaves. And 5 years ago, I was in mortgage lending as well as real estate, but primarily a lender. I had to get my real estate license in order to be able to teach real estate, and by teaching and building value for all those people, that's how I was getting my referral sources to get mortgages. And on my show, when someone called in and said to me, when is the real estate bubble going to pop, because they felt like it was going to pop, I said, that's not what you have to worry about. And I was watching underwriting guidelines changing by the minute, not just by the day, week, or month, but by the minute, and how they were relaxing guidelines and how, you know, there was hand-in-hand client as well as loan officer fraud going on. But just the mortgage products themselves were ridiculous, and they're doing all of these 3- and 5-year ARMs. And while, yeah, they were able to get the interest rate into the single digits for subprime borrowers, the first interest rate adjustment when that ARM would adjust after their fixed period was a six-digit or a six-point spread. And to go from a 3% mortgage to a 9% mortgage when people were maxed out on their qualifying at the 3 because people were being greedy and trying to buy the biggest house they could, you know, that was what I thought, you know, predicated what went on in the marketplace. And I said, you give it 3 to 5 years and the financial markets are going to have a devastating blow unlike anything you've ever seen. And nobody listened to me back then, and I kept saying it. And a couple years ago, I was actually in Hong Kong when the market started their chaos, and everybody was shocked and amazed, and the look on people's face. And I just sat there, and I said, I told you all so, but you didn't listen. And, you know, I was wondering when you started to see the beginning of the crisis, when you started seeing things change, because you've been in real estate and economics so much longer than I have, you probably had a better heads up. When did you start seeing this happening?
Well, I wrote a book called The Niagara of Capital that was published in 2007, and in that book I said that this process could, this was at the where the beginning of the collapse of the lending system was beginning. I said this process cannot go on indefinitely, and it has to change. And so I didn't foresee it as far perhaps as you did, but I foresaw that this bubble was going to end. But I didn't anticipate that the whole lending system would collapse the way it has. And
yeah,
I think very few other people anticipated that we would get a complete shutdown of lending, which is what we had, especially in 2008.
Well, I knew it was going to have repercussions because some of our staunch, what we referred to in the industry as our vanilla or A-paper lenders, which were doing conforming conventional loans, and they wouldn't even consider that trash in the 90s. And then all of a sudden in 03 and 04, some of these cornerstones of financial institutions started allowing some of those products into their portfolio. That's when I said, oh, my God, this is going to be worse than ever, because, you know, it's one thing if some stupid little crappy bank on the corner who's trying to, you know, be a loan shark, it goes under. But if our big, you know, stable, century-old financial institutions go down, we're going to have a big problem.
Which we do.
And, you know, yeah, yeah, and it blew me away. That's when I knew that it was going to be bigger than anybody could anticipate is when I saw some of the, you know, what I felt were cornerstone financial institutions, you know, starting to allow that product into their mix. But, you know, I've read a ton about this, and there was a lot of government regulatory oversight that just looked the other way.
Yes, that's true.
You know, they allow this to happen.
Well, but I think that is very true. But on the other hand, the people who made it happen are the ones that bear the real guilt, because they were letting greed run away with them and doing things that any lender certainly would, with any brains, would not do, particularly some of the terms that you just described in subprime lending, where you don't have to make a down payment, you don't have to you can even make a loan where what you can pay is less than the loan interest rate, but you were allowed to add that to the principal of your loan instead of paying it. So there are all kinds of things that were done by the mortgage banking industry that were really grossly stupid and led them into the disaster they're in now.
Well, you know, and I just think of, you know, the clerk that makes, you know, $12 an hour at Home Depot, and they're buying a $300,000 condo with a $200 a month association fee, and they're stating income. You know, stated income was never meant for wage earners. It was always meant for commission people, because, you know, if my mortgage payment goes up next month, I can go sell another house. I can write another loan and have more money. But these people, no matter how many pieces of plywood or nails they ring up, they're $12 an hour.
They were not even asked to prove their stated income in some cases. The lender was allowed to state whatever he wanted to say as his income, and the borrower was, and the lender accepted it. So all of this is partly explained by an economist named Hyman Minsky, who had the theory that the longer prosperity exists in over a period of time, the more optimistic both borrowers and lenders become. And as they become more optimistic, they decide to use more leverage. The borrowers borrow more money and the lenders lend more money. The borrowers, because the more they borrow, the higher the return on this limited amount of equity they put up. And the lenders, because the more they lend, the more money they can make from interest and fees. So that he predicted that this would be the result of an ever-rising dependence on debt and over-leveraging, which then some unexpected event would come along that with a downward movement on the economy, and that would cause all of the borrowers, the lenders rather, to ask the borrowers to pay them now, and the lenders would find that the borrowers were not able to do it because they had over-leveraged themselves and they didn't have the income from their properties was not adequate to support the demands of the lenders to be repaid. And that would cause the kind of crisis we are in. And he thought the only way to get out of it was for the government to spend a lot of money trying to reduce interest rates and maybe make some concessions to borrowers so that they wouldn't have to be driven to the wall. And, of course, that's exactly what we're doing.
Yeah, and with all of the government interference now, it's just making it worse with, you know, our president standing up there telling us to continue to borrow and buy houses and do things, when clearly people were not capable and prepared for the opportunity of home ownership.
Well,
and so I don't feel like we're solving anything.
He's not telling everybody to buy houses. He's telling people that if you have the capability of buying a house, we're going to try and make it easier for you to do it. But the government is caught in a real paradox right now and a difficulty because, on the one hand, the country has cut back on its consumption dramatically in the past, 18 months, and that has caused the recession to get much worse. On the other hand, we've been overspending for many years, and we've been running a very large trading deficit especially with Asian countries, that has financed our ability to overspend it. And in the next few years, we're going to have huge increases in federal government spending because of Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security as the baby boomers retire. And so we actually need to reduce our consumption. So the reduction in consumption we've had is a good thing for the long run, but it's a bad thing in the short run, and the government is now heavily concerned with what's happening in the short run. So they're trying to make us consume more than we are now and to move backwards towards where we were in 2006. Over that period, our share of consumption in gross domestic product rose from about 60% earlier, a couple decades ago, to 72% in 2006, which is a tremendous increase in consumption, and we were over-consuming. And we're going to have to stop doing that in the long run, but in the short run, the government's trying to get us to resume some spending, as is evident from the automobile industry, where they're trying to make it possible for the automobile companies to sell cars to somebody. That means somebody has to buy them.
Yeah, agreed. And when we can't afford them, and now we're encouraged to borrow to go buy them, I mean, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy that's going to continue until...
I think that the government is right in saying that it's going to take government spending or government subsidies to get us out of this situation. And if you didn't have that spending or those subsidies, our recession would become much worse than it is now that they're trying to spend their way out of it. Now, that doesn't mean it would be of all problems, but for the government to do nothing would be a big mistake.
Well, why don't they let the good businesses thrive and the bad businesses fail? I mean, I understand that there's a lot of people that are employed by some of the big three, but, you know, it irritates me that, you know, they won't allow them to go into bankruptcy, and they think that that's bad when the unions are busting them, and that needs to be restructured. And then I hear that a gentleman who had a successful Chrysler dealership for decades in Florida, the government took it away from him, took his inventory away from him, didn't pay him for it, and shut him down.
That's Chrysler, not the government.
Wow. But isn't the government running Chrysler now? I was told now that they saw bankruptcy protection that the government is going in and doing that.
No, I don't think so. I don't think the government made that decision. I think that was made by Chrysler executives. And they're the ones that decided both to push their more cars on their dealers and more cars and parts on their existing dealers, and then to cut a lot of them out of the business. That was their decision. That wasn't the government.
But why wouldn't they take out one of the non-profitable ones? I mean, that just, you know, further perpetuates the thought that why would I waste my government taxes on a company that makes ineffective decisions? Why would they get rid of a profitable dealership to shore up a not profitable one?
Well, I was not aware that was their method of discriminating. I thought it was... I'm not sure.
Well, it happened to a friend of mine. That's how I know about this. And it was my friend's, college buddy that got his dealership shut down. And it was ridiculous because it was a profitable one in an effort to shore up the less profitable ones. And that does not make sense. And that smacks of Atlas Shrugged like you would not believe. And
I don't think you can blame the government for that. It's... Chrysler is the one that made those decisions. The government didn't make it.
Well, I hope that it wasn't made by the government, but it's still an ineffective decision that my tax dollars are funding from those bailouts. And, it just doesn't make sense. If they want to sell more cars, why wouldn't they shut down the dealerships that aren't selling cars?
I don't think that was the major basis of their decision. I don't know what it was, but I don't think that was it. They didn't rank all people by how many cars they sold and just close the ones that sold the most. That's not rational. I don't think they did that. Well, I don't know exactly how they made that decision, but I don't think it was made by the government's officials. I think it was made by Chrysler executives.
Well, how do you feel, or what do you feel the government needs to do from here, and, you know, how do we continue to shore up this ungodly monster of a budget that the government has already spent and is continuing to spend, and, you know, where do we go from here?
Well, I think that what the president has said he wants to do is to work on improving our educational system, improving our healthcare system, and trying to get the banks back in business. Those are the sort of the three basic things he wants to do. And then also change our energy, method of handling energy. And we do need to do all those things. And the problem of the budget is a big problem to which there's no easy solution. We're going to have to spend a lot of money to get ourselves out of it. And if there are several things that could happen. If we spend too much money, we might generate inflation, and that might cause us to start to have inflation. That will only occur mm-hmm. after we get out of the recession, however. So to get out of the recession, we're going to have to spend more money than he's spending now. Then, if we succeed in doing that, there's a danger that that might generate inflation. And in order to stop the inflation, we might have to do something like Paul Volcker did in 1980, which is raise interest rates and cause a recession, but not as big a recession as we're now in. So that's one of the, in my book on real estate and the financial crisis, which is the one I just finished, there are four different scenarios about what's going to happen in this recession. One, the first scenario is that it'll be over in 2009. I think that is a low probability, about 15%. The second one is that the recession will last through 2009 and most of 2010, and I give that a probability of 65%. The third one is that the value of the dollar will collapse and cause other countries to not use the dollar as their major means of exchange, and they will drive down the value of the dollar, and that'll cause the Federal Reserve to have to raise interest rates to stop the decline of the dollar, and that will make the recession worse and lengthen it beyond 2010. I give that a low probability, I think about 8%. And the last one is that we'll spend our way out of the recession, but that will cause enough inflation, so we'll have to have another recession, but a milder one, to solve that problem. And that I give about a 12% probability. So those are the four outcomes that I predict one of those will happen. And I think that the one that's most likely is that we'll have a recession will continue well past 2009 into 2010. But the other things are possible. So I don't think that we're going to get out of this in 2009. But we could.
I don't either.
But I think we'll get out of it maybe toward my highest probability is towards the end of 2010. And one of the reasons for that is that the housing markets are still having declining prices, and the number of foreclosures is rising rapidly. Last year, there were 3 million foreclosures filed for, and actual foreclosures are running about 25% to 33% of the filings on foreclosures. So this year, we're probably going to have more than 3 million filings, and only next year do I think there's any possibility of the housing construction business coming back into any strength. It was very low in 2008, the number of new starts, and it's going to be lower in 2009, in my opinion. But it may start to recover in 2010, but not until then.
Well, we had too much inventory and urban sprawl here in Arizona anyway, so it's fine that the home builders don't get back to work, but we're starting to absorb some of our inventory, and we're starting to see certain segments of our market come back, you know. So entry-level housing is starting to rebound as those foreclosures seem to be tapering off. And a lot of people just jumped ship and got out because they knew that it wasn't worth saving. And so I think we're starting to see the number of closings are going up here, and they've been pretty consistently high over the last couple of months here in Arizona. And the number of those being foreclosure sales are going down. So that's a good thing for us here.
That's not what's happening in California. That's not what's happening in California, where the percentage of foreclosures in all sales has gone to, was over 70% in August and September of last year, and I think it's even higher than that now. And one of the things that bothers me about the recovery in the housing market, such as it is, that many of the purchasers of foreclosed housing are investors, or what I think really the proper word is speculators, who were buying the house and hoping to resell it at a much higher price. And they were the part of the group that caused the problem in the first place of overbuilding housing, because so many of them were buying houses not to occupy but to sell to somebody else. And that increased the demand for housing. And the home builders, who always build as many houses as they possibly can without regard to the future, built too many houses. In both 2004 and 2005, we had over 2 million housing units built each year. And a lot of those were going to these speculators. And I think it's not going to be good for the economy for speculators to enter the foreclosure housing market again and cause, even if they've caused the price to stop falling, I don't think that's going to be beneficial in the long run. But you might, as a broker, might like it.
Well, I mean, we've been exceptionally busy, and, you know, we do work with a lot of investors, but, you know, we create home ownership opportunities, and, you know, I mean, we're not gouging the market. We're just moving with the market we're doing. And a lot of us are doing buy and holds and putting, you know, creating quality rental properties, you know, for the people that have been foreclosed on. They still need to live somewhere. And a lot of times, you know, they can't be accommodated by an apartment setting. So they're still, now they're just not homeowners anymore, but they're renting in the single family market.
Who's owning the property?
Pardon me?
Who owns the properties?
Oh, investors, individual investors. But they're not like the ones that we saw that came into the marketplace before. The face of our investor in this marketplace versus 04 and 05, this is an individual investor. This is someone that's, you know, mom and pop, saved their money, you know, had already had a consistent real estate investment plan and actually didn't do any acquisition during the run-up and has waited for the prices to come down. And one of the good things for our market is that as a result of this, you know, our median home price is now in line with our median income, and that's been our biggest problem when we had that run-up, and I could see that it wasn't going to be sustainable because there was no way, with us being a service economy, having big resorts and lots of restaurants and things to do in this town, and, you know, being not a big production or agriculture hub like we used to be.
But,
you know,
particular?
Yes, you know, we're a service economy. So, I mean, you've got a lot of people that are really close to minimum wage and a lot of unskilled labor here. And for our prices to have gotten that high was just ridiculous anyway. You know, so now we can actually have a healthy, sustainable community now that things have, you know, now that we've shaken out a lot of this stuff.
The investors are hoping the prices will rise. They are hoping that prices will go back up, not necessarily as high as they were in 2006, but obviously, and some of these investors are buying 15 and 20 houses at a time, not just one.
Yeah, but rental ones now will cash flow where they weren't before. You could buy a rental property, it wouldn't appreciate, and it wouldn't cash flow. So now we've got, you know, good scenarios for everybody because market rents are still pretty strong. So at least, you know, in our town, we're where we want to be. I mean, I'm happy with where we are, and I feel good about this because people that are prepared and able for home ownership can now finally afford housing when they couldn't over the last few years.
Well, it gives
the opportunity.
What about the people who are foreclosed and the people who lent them money? How do they feel about that?
Well, you know, I have a pretty harsh view about that. I'm not sure sharing my opinion about that is probably the right thing to do. But, you know, like they say, love and hate walk the same street hand in hand, and the true opposite of love is indifference. And they both walk down that street hand in hand. People knew what they could afford, but they allowed their appetites to buy more. You know, they worked in concert with the lender. I don't have a whole lot of compassion for those people. I'm sorry. That's just the way it is. You know, it's a gamble. Life is a gamble. You know, just like God gave free will, we have freedom of choice. We can do what we want. And, you know, you gotta be accountable for the ramifications of your actions. And if you bought low and you made money, great. But if you bought high and lost your tail, that's not my problem. That's not the government's problem to bail out. That's not the bank who you obligated and made a commitment to honor. That's your issue. You know, and I feel bad for the banks because people feel like banks are faceless entities, these big corporations. But you and me and everybody else that pays.
I can't hear you now. I've lost you. Hello. Hello, I'm sorry, I can't hear you. I seem to have lost you.
I've had it up to here, listening to a small segment of people trying to put down America. America's the greatest land on earth, and we ought to be proud of what we have. I'm proud of America.
Okay, are you there?
Hello? Hello?
Hello.
You know what, Tom?
Hi.
Hello.
Hello?
Are we
no,
back?
No.
Yes.
Well,
can you
oh,
hear
you
me?
Are. Okay, I'm going to hang up.
Okay.
Sorry about that. I'm not sure exactly what happened.
No, I'm not here.
Okay. I had a technical issue. I'm not sure at what point... I was cut off from you, but what I was saying, you know, was that there are other culpable people, and I don't know when people vilify the banks, even though the banks lent the money, people made commitments to these banks, and you know, it affected all of us, no matter whether or not we were the borrower or the bank, because me and you put money into 401ks and retirement accounts and mutual funds and invested in these banks and these stocks and bonds that helped provide the money to lend. So we're, you know, banks aren't a faceless entity. There are people at the back end of all of that, and people got crushed, not just
well, not only that,
banks or our financial institutions.
The economic system cannot function without banks to lend money to all kinds of businesses and individual families, because our system is based on all kinds of entities borrowing in order to get going and to keep their businesses in operation. So that's why the government is so worried about the banks and why they are trying to bail out some of the biggest banks. And the biggest banks, the 10 largest banks in the country, there are 8,451 banks in the country, but the 10 largest control two-thirds of all the assets in all the banks. And the five largest control half, more than half of all the assets in all the 8,451 banks. So they have a huge amount of all the assets in our banking system are in the top big banks, the ones that you hear about in all this discussion in Washington. And though we may not like them, and I don't particularly care for them, nevertheless, we've got to, if they fail, and all of their assets are wiped out, many of the pension funds that you have invested in or others have invested in have bought shares in mutual funds who bought shares in these 10 big banks. So that would have a devastating effect on the pension situation in the country, just like the drop in asset prices in September and October last year did. So that's one of the reasons why the government is interested in keeping the banks in being and not letting the big banks who hold all those assets fail, even though it's expensive to do and people don't like the fact that the banks got very well paid in the past and now are demanding government. They're not demanding, but they need government assistance. And it is right for the government to try and revive the banking system, because otherwise we'll never get out of this recession.
Mm-hmm. Well, a final question for you, for the audience. How can we as individuals weather this storm? What little gems do you have for us while we're trying to go through this? What advice can you give us?
Well, I think that you, because we're in a recessionary period, we're going to have to, most individual households and firms are have to cut back on their expenditures and try to save, which is what many people are doing. We had a negative savings rate in the United States for some years. Suddenly it's gone positive. Now, the government is trying to get people to spend more money to get us out of this recession. And so I think when you see opportunities for spending and you have the money and it's something you really need, then perhaps you should buy it. But I don't think we should all we've all cut back on our spending, and that for individuals and households, that's a good thing under these circumstances. As you see opportunities for some spending to reappear, then it's good for the country if you spend the money, but it's not necessarily good for you or in the long run. So it's a very difficult choice to make. And I think that we all have to be more economically conservative than we were in 2000 to 2006, and that we are not going to return to that level of spending, and we shouldn't return to it. So that's why the government has a bigger role to play until we get ourselves out of this negative economic situation we're in, because individuals are not going to leap forward and do all kinds of big spending to return us to what we were like in 2006, and they shouldn't. But somebody has to provide some resources that will make up for the fact that individuals and firms and households are not doing that, and that somebody's the government. And that's what the government is trying to do.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the program today, Dr. Downs. We really appreciate your insight. And for those that are listening live, your book, The Real Estate and the Financial Crisis and the Niagara of Capital, are available on Amazon for purchase. So thanks again for joining us, and we look forward to the next publication you have. More on the nuts and bolts and riches up next on Unlock Your Wealth Radio. I'm Heather Wagenhall. Stay tuned.
If I were a rich man, all day long I'd busy, busy long. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a busy, busy rich, idle, 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 idle man, I'd build a big tall house with rooms by the thousand, right in the middle of the town. A fine tin roof with real wooden floors below. There could be one long staircase just going up, and one even longer coming down, and one more leading nowhere just for show.
Welcome back to the broadcast. You're listening to Unlock Your Wealth Radio. I'm Heather Wagenhals, and now it's time for Nuts and Bolts, the moment you have all been waiting for. Now, today's key is break the budget, and we've been at it now. For those of you who have been at it for a while, you will have your assessment envelopes ready to go and sort through. For those of you who are just joining us for the first time, The Keys to Riches is a baker's dozen of financial concepts that not only teach you how to think like the rich and be in control of your own money, but also give you specific techniques to create or fix your credit, reduce debt, save and invest, building wealth through real estate, all while transforming your current financial habits into healthy money management skills. Now, this week's key is about breaking the budget. And when people talk about money management, the first thing that they want to do is create a budget. All right, everybody, let's create a budget. All right, well, now we want to get our lifestyle under control. Let's create a budget. And people go and they say, oh, well, I think that I want to spend, you know, $100 on groceries, and I want to spend this much on entertainment, and I want to spend this much on whatever. And people plan to budget their income, but they forget about their obligations, like their debt on credit cards, car payments, you know, house payments, all of that stuff. They don't think about, do I have emergency funds set up? Am I financially prepared for a catastrophic event, which is what we just talked about, on hope for the best, plan for the worst. And then they get going, and they think that they're doing good, and then either a catastrophic event happens or their budget just doesn't work. They're too constrained. And, you know, if you are the head of a household of a family of four, and, you know, you give yourself $100 a month budget for groceries, like, that won't even buy a week's worth of groceries. And so you're not going to survive, because then you're going to try, you're fixated on this number, how do I make this number, and you're going to be sacrificing and starving and starting to resent having to be on a budget. And that's where there's no long-term success, because most budgets are too radical. They don't take into account every expenditure, and they don't really consider what we do psychologically with our money that is going to be self-sabotaging, that, you know, a budget may not even be within our capability just because of the way we're wired. And so as a result, what we need to do is break the budget. We need to distance ourselves from that whole idea, because it's just like dieting. You know, we went through this in the first hour, so I won't go over it again too much. And for those of you that are just joining us and missed the first hour, you can always go back and download this show after it airs, and we're going to start uploading them on podcasting as well. So you'll be able to carry it with you on any MP3 player, iPod, iTunes, you name it, you'll be able to find it. So I don't want to belabor the dieting part, but, you know, when you sacrifice, when you finally loosen things because you think it's time to come off, that's when you go bananas, and or you fall off the wagon accidentally. And it's never conservative. You know, when people yo-yo diet and they go on these radical diets, they put back weight, then some. And that's exactly what happens when we budget, and we sacrifice. And then, you know, when we finally say, well, I'm worth it, and I've been budgeting for a whole long time, and whether or not that budgeting's been successful, but the fact that you feel like you've been at it a while entitles you to splurge, and then you go out, and it's usually worse than if you just would have been buying, like, little things all along. So what we do with break the budget is, number one, change the mindset, and then number two, we budget in a systematic fashion. So for those of you that were able to collect your receipts for the appropriateness of your pay periods on the for your assessment envelope, and again, for those of you who haven't done the assessment key, I encourage you to download that broadcast and listen to how to get started. And then all of this part will make sense too, but it should make sense anyway. What you want to do is categorize all of your spending into groups. All right, so take all of your receipts that you spend on food, and that's also eating out and things like that. And then you also want to categorize your utilities. These also go in, so you need those statements as well. And you need to compile everything, like clothing, parking, you know, valet tickets, any of that stuff. If you've been making trips to the vending machine, that all goes into your food. And you want to group them into these major categories. And I will send you an instructional worksheet if you send an email and sign up for the e-zine today. And in the subject line, if you email me and just say budget worksheet, I'd be happy to send you via email a way to set this up and categorize and filter the information down. You can send that email to ezine@unlockyourwealth.com. ezine@unlockyourwealth.com. So we're going to put all of these things in our categories, and then we're going to work one category at a time. Now, all of our utilities are in the same category, and what we need to do then is separate the categories from need versus want. So we make two piles. So like electricity is a need. A cable TV is a want. Okay? So we start sorting these things out. And as we break down each category, we're going to start analyzing our spending. But it's not just a need versus want, because, again, if we make too many sacrifices, we're not going to be able to stick to this. So as we sort through this, everybody advocates needs versus want spending. And what we need to do is determine all of our need spending and our want spending. And just because you want it doesn't make it so. And after we sort through all of this and we categorize, we want to write down and add up all of our categories on our needs spending and see where that falls with regard to our income. And I'm not talking gross income, but what we actually net in our paychecks, okay? And see how much room we have to be. And start with utilities first, because whether you're renting or owning, you have to pay for utilities. So you want to start there first. Then you want to take your housing expenditures and vehicle expenditures and do our needs versus wants. A Hyundai Elantra, a Honda Accord, a Nissan Sentra is a need. A S-Class Mercedes is a want. Transportation is a need, but within that category, there are other categories. So as we call our list of our wants and our needs, and we add up all of our needs, if there's still room there, now we can start looking at our wants, because we have essential wants that are not needs, as we think they are, but they're the priority wants. And if those aren't able to be added back with a savings plan first, because it's called a savings and spending plan for a reason, because we're going to be saving our income, and our goal is to get up to 20%, we're going to try to figure out ways that we can accomplish these same wants, these essential wants, but being able to do it in a different way that maybe is cheaper. Like instead of buying Starbucks every day at Starbucks for $5 a cup, we could make it at home for $8 a bag, which will provide us a zillion cups. So for more information, send me an email and we can continue this discussion online. But our key statement for the week is, I know that trying to create and stick to a budget is a losing proposition because it means sacrifice. Therefore, to be truly financially independent, I must create and stick to a realistic, healthy savings and spending plan. Our key affirmation for the week is, I have and execute a healthy savings and spending plan. And you want to add that to your affirmation list. And again, we say those in the morning, in the evening, and any time we encounter negativity. And then our key action item for the week is to categorize our assessment envelope, evaluate for needs versus wants, subtract out our needs, work on our essential wants, and then figure out how we can reallocate those and still incorporate our savings plan so we can begin to take control of our financial futures. Again, have a happy Memorial Day weekend, a big salute and a thank you to all of our soldiers currently and previously served in our armed forces. I welcome you and encourage you to recognize someone who has served in our armed forces and thank them for their service, as I continually thank and am grateful for my brothers. For more information about the show, visit us at www.unlockyourwealth.com. Follow us on Twitter at UnlockYRWealth and subscribe to the e-zine as well as Twitter so you can receive your Money May Money Tips of the Day. That's e-zine at UnlockYourWealthRadio.com, or you can do that yourself simply by dropping in an email on the website. Again, unlockyourwealth.com. Thanks so much, and make it a great weekend.
I've had it up to here, listening to a small segment of people trying to put down America. America's the greatest land on earth, and we ought to be proud of what we have. I'm proud of America. I'm proud of our people, and I'm going to prove it. We're American, and damn proud of it.
Frankly, I'm getting a little ticked off.
Go to hell.